welcome to episode one of the Back to Front Show. My name's Kieran Whittaker, and each week I'll be joined by my code collaborator friend, Mr. Kieran Masterton. Hello, Kieran.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
Not too bad. So we're hoping Skype will kind of do its thing for about the next 40 minutes.
Stand up and stay connected.
Yeah, between Bath and Wells in the beautiful West Country. No snow at the moment. What about you?
Not yet, no.
It's due, which will probably pay to most technology and transport in the area. But so it's a new year, and we decided to get behind the mics, the Blue Yetis, for a weekly show called the Back to Front Show. The idea being, well, why don't you explain what the idea is?
Well, I think really we were just going to talk about front-end, back-end coding, everything in between, bit of coffee, bit of code, that kind of thing.
Code, coffee, cocktails, something like that?
Yes, yeah, something like that. Isn't that your bio?
It actually probably is. Slow media, i.e. magazines.
Oh, slow media,
yeah. It's a bit pretentious way of saying magazines.
Nice bit of print.
Nice bit of print. Smells good. Always smells good. Yeah. So, yeah, you can find, well, once we put it live, the Back to Front Show. Actually, it's not the Back to Front Show, is it? It's backtofrontshow.com will be our home, and Back to Front Show on Twitter as well. So, as you said, each week, some back-end topics, some front-end topics, and probably plenty more in between.
More in between than anything else.
But why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Kieran? What's your name and where do you come from?
Well, I'm Kieran Masterton. I'm from Wells in sunny Somerset. And I'm a freelance developer.
Ah, freelance. Interesting you say that, because we've both been talking about sort of writing bios recently, because you've kind of gone out on your own after working in a company, a couple of you. And one of the things that we were talking about the other day was that you noticed that more and more people are calling themselves independent instead of freelance.
I've seen a bit of a trend towards that, both in design and in development, actually, and also, you know, elsewhere in sort of editing and media production and that kind of thing. People tending to describe themselves as independent rather than freelance.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because actually writing your bio to try and explain what you do when you have a broad skill set, particularly in the web industry, whether you know, front-end developer or you're web designer, you know, are you a sysadmin? What's some of the difficulties that you've experienced of trying to kind of write those short bios to explain what you do? And you know, at the end of the day, does it really matter whether you describe yourself as freelance or independent? What kind of things do you think it gives off?
Well, I've definitely struggled with it. I think that there's definitely a tendency to go a bit too flowery and tell people things that you don't really need to, you know, go into. But I do think it's important in general how you sort of self-identify. And I think a bio is kind of, you know, a reflection of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I tend to try and sort of give people, you know, exactly what it is that I do, but I always end up sort of veering off into language that possibly people wouldn't understand. You know, we've talked about before words like technologist and things like that, that unless you're part of the industry, you don't really have an understanding of what that is.
Yeah, I think you probably need a couple of bios in reality, don't you? One for your industry peers that sort of says whether you know your particular language, PHP, Ruby on Rails, frameworks, that kind of stuff, WordPress, and then something that if your client base isn't within the industry that you can, you know, put on your footers and your emails, that kind of stuff. I find, you know, I've had the same problem. I sort of wear a number of hats and sort of web developer doesn't really cut it. I work with Shopify, I do stuff with Viewport Industries, with Elliot, and a lot of that is publishing, but I'm not really a publisher. So I find it very, very difficult to not be too flowery, put it that way. So when anyone
on Twitter, where there's sort of, there is only one bio and you know, you don't want to, but you just have a huge list of job titles.
Yeah. Which, like, you know, some kind of polymath, which clearly I'm not, but yeah. So what did you end up with in the end? Are you independent or are you freelance?
No, I'm neither.
Oh, you're neither.
You know, in discussions with people, you know, I think they felt it didn't really matter. You know, it's all about how you communicate, what you do, and when, you know, I think once someone's clicked through to my website or whatever, it's fairly obvious that I'm touting for work.
Yeah.
So it's not a need to put freelance in front of that. I think in some cases it probably is, especially if you've recently left a company maybe you were employed by an agency or something. People know you for working for that agency. It could probably be useful to, you know, for a time to have freelance in your bio. But I am interested by this use of independent, because obviously I do a fair amount of work with sort of film and stuff, and obviously independent's a very, you know, commonly used term there, and it's vague even in that context. You know, independent can mean, well, really the money's coming from a studio, or it can mean, you know, I'm a DIY filmmaker in my mum's bedroom, you know. So I think that independent is an interesting word to be picked up by web developers and designers.
Yeah, maybe there's also a connotation of pricing with independent. Maybe freelance suggests a certain rate, where independent kind of maybe dresses it slightly different. And I think there's also that idea when people work for themselves and they have a company, they refer to, you know, is it we, is it me, is it I? All those kind of things, again, also sort of creep into how you describe yourself. And I mean, there's hundreds of articles online about whether you should describe your one or two person company, or, you know, it's I or we or me and all those kind of things. It's more of a challenge than you would think, describing yourself in a non too flowery way.
Yeah, it is. And I think that, you know, I've recently had that we, I, you know, issue when writing copy for my website, and you know, it is just me. But if you're trading under a name, then people almost expect it to be we. And, you know, whereas I do pull in freelancers and stuff to work with me, I don't have any other permanent member of staff. So, you know, sometimes it can feel a little disingenuous to be saying we and to be pretending. But I think as long as you make it clear, you know, that it is just you, and that, you know, you are the company, even if it has a brand name, I think you'd be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can always change it. Why not? See what works. A-B test your bio. Now, there's a thing. Maybe we could do an app for that.
Yeah.
Why not? So another thing we've been sort of struggling with recently is sort of office space and where to work. I mean, I'm sat at home in my bedroom at the moment. I guess you're in your home office.
Yes.
And I read an article recently on Fast Company Design, I think it was, about co-working and how there's this huge rise towards co-working, and how people cite the sort of creativity and the mixing of sort of disciplines in one place to be, you know, increase productivity and that kind of thing. And both of us used to spend far too long in Starbucks in Bath working, and it felt productive at the time.
Yes.
I think I've changed quite a bit though, and the notion of co-working now is maybe losing its appeal a little bit. But equally, office space is expensive, and you know, it's quite a commitment, especially if you sort of travel around a bit with your job and that kind of stuff. What's your opinion on co-working?
I've never worked in a co-working space, but obviously I've worked in office space. And as you say, we've spent our fair share of time sitting in coffee shops with other developers. I think that this is my take on it, but I think I'm not entirely sure whether productivity comes from these environments, or whether maybe it's more about collaboration. And you know, people I talk to who are in those environments tend to be very much sort of excited by them, because person X or person Y is in there, and they get a lot of energy from working in the same space as those people. But for me, I'm not sure it would be about productivity. You know, I tend to plug myself in, headphones on, and that's how I code. We've talked about, you know, co-working in terms of, you know, the different types of co-working spaces, and whether they're, you know, silent, all you can hear is typing, or whether they're very much you know, shouty collaborative type spaces. And I'm not sure that, you know, I need a mix of that, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the sort of attractions of a co-working space, that you're going to be sat next to someone who's maybe a designer or developer or, you know, marketing or whatever, and you can sort of pick their brains almost for free, because at some point they're going to come and pick your brains. Yeah. And I always think when you hang out with people from different disciplines and different industries, that it makes you reassess how you view your own industry and your own work, and it gives you other ideas. So I think it's very furtive in that sense.
Yeah.
I used to kind of thrive off the sort of atmosphere of sitting in coffee shops, but more recently, last year and a half, I found that in order to actually sort of churn out code particularly, I almost sit in silence. You know, I'll often find myself putting my headphones on with the idea of listening to music, and then realize for the last hour I've been sat there without anything sort of piping through them. And so I think it's interesting how I feel I've changed in terms of the sort of work environment I like to actually churn out code in. If it's email or just sort of chatting, obviously those situations are great. So, but it comes down to sort of finances in a sense, doesn't it? Is yeah. paying £200 a month for having a co-working space worth it? You know, how do you justify that? How do you measure the value of sort of enrolling in these places?
I think it's very hard, and especially when you're in, well, for me, I'm relatively rural.
Out there in the country.
Out there in the sticks. And I think so I would have to actually commute to any co-working space that I was going to go to, and anything is really sort of half an hour, 25 minutes away from me, which I don't mind because I kind of like that break. I was going to say just now that I tend to find that I'm not very productive. I get up in the morning, make myself a coffee and come to my home office because I tend to... there's not been that break between work and home that I need. And so, you know, I tend to like it when I drive into Bath to, you know, sit in a coffee shop with you or whatever it might be. Or when we had an office in Bath, it was nice that sort of, I had that 25, 30 minute time to change my mindset from home to work. And that's why I tend to get up in the morning and go straight to a coffee shop and work there for the morning.
Right.
But equally, as I've said to you in the past, I would, you know, I'd really like that to be a co-working space because, you know, first of all, you do feel a bit like a squatter in coffee shops. I'm never quite sure how much coffee shop owners like people like us working there. It does feel slightly unprofessional if someone calls you.
Yeah, see, I've never really worried about that. Just generally look unprofessional, so it doesn't really matter. Yeah, so what's the etiquette around your parts? Is it sort of coffee every hour or do you just buy the biggest one you can and sort of let it sit there and then go and ask for a cup of water? How do you play it?
I don't really have a rule as such, but I do try and, you know, buy a couple of coffees each morning just because I don't want to be seen as someone who buys the cheapest possible coffee and sits there for as long as possible. Though there are students and things sitting around me doing that, so, you know, I feel like I'm not the worst offender.
Not the worst. Won't be the last. Yeah, it's an interesting one, particularly sort of in, relevant to Bath, where I'm based. Is that hopefully opening later in the year is going to be a whole sort of refit of the Guildhall, which anyone who knows Bath is a kind of old building in the centre of town, actually opposite our old office of Starbucks. And they've got big plans for that, and so it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. A whole bunch of different rooms and different ideas and how that's priced up. So definitely check it out. But I think I spend so long sort of pontificating about what to do about offices, I'll probably never get one. So we'll see.
I understand what you feel, though, in terms of, you know, you want to have a space that you go to that is, you know, puts you in that right mindset.
Yeah, that's very true. Also, you know, I know you have a dog, which is like your child, but I have two
dog child,
two children as well. And so home is very much focused around, you know, family life and that sort of break between the two to sort of change your mindset. I think that's really what's important and sort of getting out of the house every day kind of makes you feel a bit more like you're working. The Fast Company article is really, really interesting. They've taken some lovely shots of co-working spaces around the world, mainly in the States. There's a beautiful one in Chicago that we were talking about earlier and a couple of others in Brooklyn and Greenville as well. So I think we'll see more and more of this. Certainly crunching the numbers on the back of a sort of napkin, it's hard to make these work, I think. You need a lot of people who are interested and like-minded. So not the easiest thing to get off the ground, but I can imagine it'd be a lot of fun to run one. So I'll put the link in the show notes so anyone who's interested in the idea can
The rise in co-working spaces is a result of more distributed workforce in terms of more and more companies are happy for you to be wherever you want to be as long as you're online and available on chat type thing?
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, we both work with companies based around the world, and so they have no real reason to know where you are. I think it's it talks in the article about companies like Twitter and other ones, when they have sort of team out on the road, they give them passes to, I think it's Regis in the States, which are beautiful sort of drop-in centres, so they can go and work there. So they've still got a nice environment that sort of feeds creativity, but isn't necessarily a permanent office. So, and there's a few of those in the UK as well. We, for the Insights of Book launch last year, we had a space, well, we hired the space called GH Media in, what is that, Islington.
Oh, that was nice, yeah.
Yeah, really nice. And they've got some permanent desks. They've got a drop-in centre and kind of a meeting space. And you can pay a subscription annually. And you can they've just got one in Soho in London now. So you can drop in there and you can use the one in Islington. So it's kind of home from home. Maybe we kind of need to find two or three of those around the sort of West Country and just meet at one independently, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely worth a read. And there's some very lovely offices to admire. And
yeah.
But why don't we start with our first sort of back end topic this week? And this is something that we've both seen a trend towards in the last sort of year, couple of years. And that's the move away from dynamic sites to sort of, how would you describe them? Statically generated sites? Things like Jekyll
It's a move. First of all, it was a move to NoSQL. And then it was a move away from any database at all, or any data store at all, to flat files, I think was the trend, really.
Yeah, so Jekyll's one that springs to mind. Why don't you explain a bit about, I think, is that a Ruby kind of static file generator?
I haven't used it, but I think it's a it's a Ruby-based framework or site that's effectively, I think it uses YAML for its configuration.
Right, okay.
So it's very much it's very much one of these sites that's saying, you know, there's no need for any data store whatsoever. It is it's all flat files, that therefore there is less overhead every time the page is loaded.
Right, okay. So to publish an article on a blog, you'd literally write your copy in some text file and you'd literally push that to the server. Is that the idea, or?
That's how I understand it, yeah.
Yeah, because there's another site I saw this week called Site44, which links into Dropbox. And I know a few companies have sort of toyed around with using Dropbox to sort of host sites. I think the way this one works is you drop your files into your Dropbox, which syncs with a Dropbox folder on the Site44 servers, and then literally you have a published site.
So with that, are you limited to just a subdomain on their site? Because I've seen this, but all the examples are sort of subdomain.site44.com, or is it literally you can map any domain to it?
That's a good question. I haven't I noticed the same, but I haven't dug any deeper. I just thought it was interesting that there's more sort of companies are coming out with products that allow you to publish static sites.
Yeah.
And I wonder how friendly that is if you're sort of working with clients. There's a really nice, I guess you could call it, framework called Kirby. Which again is a flat file sort of driven site. You push text files up to the server, and then that kind of generates all the different areas of your site.
Okay, PHP, right?
Yes, it's in PHP. Yeah. And I think, is it Jessica Hish? It's done her new site in it.
Sorry, recently, yeah.
A bunch of other people are using it as well. So I just find it interesting that we went through this kind of move towards really nice interface, you know, you enter text, it's saved in the database and all that kind of stuff. And we seem to be, or certainly maybe at the higher end of the industry, maybe it's more industry people are doing it, moving away from that and going to sort of flat file sites.
I think it definitely depends on the application. It tends to be that I think if it's a personal portfolio type site, these things seem to be becoming increasingly popular. But I know obviously at the sort of corporate end of things, online publishers, that kind of thing, they're still very much tied to relational databases, you know, WordPress and the like. So I think it really depends on the application more than anything.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've both done a lot of work with WordPress, and you can, I guess one of the criticisms is that it's slow. You know, every time you load a page, there's a whole bunch of queries that are running.
Yeah.
That has to, PHP overhead has to bring in all the different parts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a bunch of ways that you can negate that to really, really speed up your site, aren't there? Some, very simply, installing something like WP Supercache literally takes your...
offloading stuff to Nginx as well.
Yeah, taking your site, every so often it will cache the page to a flat file, which then gets served sort of by the Nginx. Is it a reverse proxy? I never can remember.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
But So what are some of your sort of top tips if you've got a maybe a WordPress site to actually kind of speed it up? What some of the
I think WordPress, you know, I know there's a lot of criticism about WordPress, but I think that, you know, it has matured a lot over the last sort of 3 or 4 years. And I definitely know from the core team's perspective, they are trying to inject a lot more professionalism into what WordPress does. In terms of speeding the site up, I guess that, you know, people obviously love WordPress because editors find it very good for workflow. So you can separate your front end and back end so that the front end of your site is served from one server and your back end is then on another server, and so it doesn't therefore affect performance of your front end. That'd be one of the first things that would be beneficial.
So you're literally separating the people, the data's getting handled through the interface, getting stored into one server, and then all the kind of public requests have been handled somewhere else.
Yeah, so fairly any traffic to WP admins being sent to one server, and then, you know, you could have multiple front end nodes for the other site that for the front end of the site that serve stuff to users. Because what tends to happen with WordPress, or at least, you know, my experience is, you have you run into issues where editors are sitting there and the WP admin's terribly slow, and that is affecting, you know, the user experience on the front end.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, separating those is really useful. I think, obviously, offloading your static assets to CDN, I think it's fairly, you know, standard practice these days.
But do you think it is? Do you think it is? I mean, I look at a lot of sites now. I mean, I've only recently just implemented it on my site, which gets no traffic. But, you know, it's a good exercise using Max CDN.
Yeah, it's a really nice service, Max CDN. I think it's certainly, with the clients I work with, it's common practice. They're probably receiving a little bit more traffic than most.
Right.
Prior to what I'm doing now, I worked for, I ran a WordPress development shop that sort of specialized in higher traffic WordPress sites. So I think maybe, you know, my opinion's slightly skewed there. But certainly I think it's become so easy to do that.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a no-brainer, really. I mean, along with, you know, gzip, for example, you know, enable gzip, it's so simple and can save you so much overhead.
Yeah, just some, if you have access to your Apache config on your server, if you're using Apache, or, you know, you can make some ridiculously big sort of bandwidth savings by using gzip and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of stuff actually in HTML5 boilerplate I was looking at today, just in terms of ways of using htaccess if you have a WordPress site or any site that runs through Apache, of kicking some of these things in as well. Obviously, if you don't have access to the Apache configuration files, you can often, more often than not, correct me if I'm wrong, implement some of this stuff with an htaccess file in the sort of root of your site. So
if your hosting provider is allowing override with htaccess, then you can change a lot of stuff with that.
You've gone very funny there. Your cold is clearly playing havoc with your microphone. Yeah, so Max CDN, we both use that. That's pretty cool plugin to WordPress as well. With WP Supercache, basically what it does, when you cache a file, it will rewrite the URLs to your static files to the CDN URL that you've chosen. And the first time that's requested by a user, the CDN will basically go and grab it and cache it externally so that it has it. So I think that was like $40 for the year or something for a basic site.
It's really good, yeah.
Cheap as chips. You obviously can use Amazon S3 as well. That's another option, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a whole range of them, and generally the prices are ridiculously low, especially with S3.
Yeah, I think if you sign up as a new user, you pretty much get S3 free for a year as well. So it's not too bad at all. What are some of the other ways we can speed up the site? I guess concatenating JavaScript and CSS, those kind of things.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that the other thing we could do, you could do, is obviously you need to make sure that your file's being baked flat as much as possible. So we talked
baked about flat. You're such a developer. Baked flat. What does that mean?
So when what you want to do is, you want to avoid PHP overhead or Ruby or whatever, when each request happens.
Right, okay.
So what a caching plugin like WP Supercache or Total Cache or any of these plugins will do is it will, if there's no cache file exists, so if there's no flat HTML file for the page that's being requested, it will create, it will, you know, run the script as it normally would, take that data that it's created and bake it into or save it into a flat file that can later be accessed when the next person comes to the site. So if those pages aren't changing, there's nothing dynamic on the pages, just creating a flat HTML version of it and then serving it through something like Nginx, which is designed to serve static files and flat files very quickly.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it provides you with a huge performance saving.
Yeah, and you can literally just install WP Supercache or Turtlecache just from the admin, can't you? And literally turn it on, and the savings are pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean, you can do this with just Apache. You don't need to implement something like Nginx. It's just that, you know, that you then save Apache overhead as well, because Apache is designed for much more dynamic pages and dynamic sites, and doesn't, you don't necessarily need all that overhead if you're just serving a flat file.
Sure, there's also a lot of tools you can use now to reduce the size of your asset files, things like JavaScript and CSS. Personally, there's a couple that I use. One is CodeKit, mm-hmm. which you can run, which will, as well as handling kind of like a compilation of SAS and LESS and all those kind of things, will also allow you to concatenate and minify your JavaScript files as well. So mm-hmm. effectively what that does, you can, there's certain sort of directives where you can say, I would like to include jQuery, followed by this script, followed by this script, followed by my own code,
right.
Combine it all into one file and then minify it. So effectively, you know, you can't really read it if you look at it in the browser, but what you've done is you're reducing the overhead. So from maybe 5 or 6 HTTP requests just to one.
Right.
And the same with the CSS, you can take out all the white space and keep that to a minimum. And obviously then if you offload those to your CDN as well, it's all adding up to a quicker serve site. So there's many, many quick wins, I think. Particularly for WordPress, which we both work in a lot.
Yeah. So would you ever move to this sort of flat file approach? Would you, for example, pay the $30 or $40 for Kirby? Because I hear good things, you know, I mean,
I hear really good things. And
something like our personal sites, for example, are a perfectly acceptable use case for that, where, you know, we blog intermittently,
rarely
content. But, you know, my instinct there is that there's not really much difference for me anyway, from just having a flat site.
Yeah, I think I'm interested to know why people would use them for blogging, because that feels kind of a very sort of dynamic type thing. You know, I go in, I can bring up the editor, I've got the WordPress app on my iPhone, I can publish, done. If you're building a site, say for a photographer or something like that, that's very rarely going to change, and you just want a nice environment that you can code up in. It's got all the sort of bells and whistles to allow you to do includes and some, you know, handy helper functions, that kind of stuff. It makes a lot of sense. Because you've got that kind of framework of tools to allow you to develop quickly. And then what the end result is, it's a flat site, which is obviously going to be very quick, as we've discussed. I'm not sure I can see a use case personally. I mean, I often work backwards and think, you know, what tools do I know? Is this applicable for, say, WordPress? Maybe it's WordPress doesn't quite fit the bill because it's too much. You know, I don't need all those things. So I work backwards and think, okay, maybe it's a kind of a perch thing. Allows you to handle sort of smaller chunks of content, that kind of thing. Or then is it really, actually, this is really 5 pages that aren't going to change much. Let me just use, you know, one of these tools to allow sort of sites to be built quite quickly, something like Kirby or what have you.
See, I struggle with that because, you know, and I'd love for someone to, you know, give me the use case for this, but I, you know, I would struggle with why not just build a flat site.
I think the reason that you wouldn't is if there's a whole bunch of helper functions, maybe, or some kind of templating tool in there that allows you just to sort of get up and running quicker.
Sure.
Whether it be a simple way to include sort of headers and footers, that kind of stuff. It might just...
Partials or whatever.
Partials in your developer world. it's like the guys who are doing Mixture. that's a nice sort of front-end development tool, because it gives you the ability to have sort of templating and basic data structures using JSON and that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of these tools coming out now where it's not really a framework, it's more of an environment to help you get sort of basic sites up and running and prototypes. And maybe that's a use case, but
yeah,
I think for publishing, it feels an odd fit to me.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, that I'm very biased to that world, just given how many people I've worked with in that field. But back to Mixture, I've been really impressed with that. I was incredibly impressed by the, you know, multiple devices all looking at the same code base, all updating automatically.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet, isn't it? So effectively what you can do is when you run Mixture, say, on your desktop, you can have your iPhone, your laptop, your iPad, your tablet, all kind of connect to what is essentially the server. And if you make a change on, and that could be clicking around on any of them, they all kind of follow suit. So you can quickly see, and I'll link up the video that Neil did in the show notes.
They'll
kind of follow each other around. They went down to the ClearLeft test lab, and the end result was pretty impressive.
Have they done that?
It'll be
impressive, I imagine.
Yeah, there's all these like little devices from sort of old Nokia phones through to tablets and whatnot. So yeah, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. But yeah, we'll see where that goes. See how you know, the developers out there use it, and more sites are published. Just keep an eye on it. It's an interesting trend, and we'll see what happens. But what's next on the agenda? Oh, a nice bit of kit. So
shiny.
So we use the Blue Yeti. We've both got a Blue Yeti, which is a really pretty nice podcasting mic, USB. But not that we tend or intend to do any kind of on the road interviews, but I came across something by Rode. They do the Rode podcaster mic as well. But they've got something called the IXY mic? I'm not sure.
IXY.
Lowercase I, capital X, Y mic, which is basically a little mic that you can plug into the top of your iDevice, the iPod or your iPhone, to allow for sort of on-the-go recording. It's pretty neat, isn't it? What did you think of that?
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, I know that there are, you know, again, having sort of contact with the film world, I know that, you know, anything that brings down the price of professional sound recording is fantastic. And this is sort of like, I think it's $200, and that's the app and the extension, you know, the mic that plugs into your iDevice, and it really does look very nice. And they've got a lovely video on their site which we should link up as well. But I know that I think sort of the sort of hand recorders that filmmakers and the like use in the field are sort of in the $300 region.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's you know, saving you a third effectively. And I can't speak to, you know, quality issues or anything like that or that kind of thing. But, it seems really impressive. And I'd love to know what someone from a sort of music background or an audio engineering background thought of it. Because, you know, I know that people shooting with DSLRs with dreadful sound on board need this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think more and more people, as I said when I sort of talked about launching yet another podcast, are doing this kind of stuff. And the technology barrier is really low now. You know, hosting's cheap. Something like Audio Hijack Pros, really, you know, $30-$40 to allow you to record Skype calls and that kind of stuff. And I think this just gives you an extra option if you're out and about or you just want to record a snippet or an interview, something like this.
I think it's really interesting when you need quality.
Yeah.
And sound is really going to affect, you know, how your end product is received, and whether that's, you know, you're making a web series, or whether you're shooting a corporate video for your startup or whatever it is, crappy sound really, you know, stands out.
Yeah, so certainly makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think that you know, stuff like this bringing down that barrier to entry is fantastic.
I'm quite tempted, I have to be honest. Maybe on the next stateside trip, I can go to the Apple store and buy one. But
see if they ship to the UK.
Mind you, you never know. $200.
They're sold out.
Oh, they're sold out. Great, it must be popular. Or they only made five. You know, one of the two. But they also do the, as I said, the Rode Podcaster, which is one of the sort of higher end podcasting mics, USB ones as well, which is really nice as well. So Rode definitely do some nice audio kit.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of shiny item of the week. But gosh, almost at 35 minutes already. And so next week is New Adventures. I think we're going to try and record episode 2 from Nottingham.
Live.
Live. Well, maybe not live.
Okay.
Maybe in the beautiful surroundings of the Premier Inn. living the dream at the Premier Inn. Next
Premier Inn breakfast bar.
Breakfast. Yeah, you enjoyed their breakfast last year.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I've been known to like a breakfast.
Not as much as Ryan Taylor.
Not as much as Ryan.
He very much enjoyed the breakfast last year. But yeah, what are you looking forward to next week?
I'm looking forward to Wayne Hemingway.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Despite his terrible adverts on television at the moment.
What they're for? So it's a UK, is it a UK company? Well, called a shisha or something? No, that's shisha. That's something you smoke in a Turkish restaurant.
It's how important design is and that kind of thing. But generally, I'm excited to hear what he has to say. I always like Jason Santamaria. Always like hearing what he has to say. John Tan's been known to
entertain
truth into the world, so that should be good as well.
Yeah, I like really like Jason's delivery, really, because he did a talk at Build, was it 2011, where he kind of said the idiot's guide to type, and he just gave you sort of four or five real classic takeaways, like the squint test. You know, if you squint your eyes, can you still read it? If not, make it a bit. Those kind of things, really, really good. But
you're very much Mr. Takeaway, aren't you?
I do like a takeaway. I'm not a big thinker.
No, I mean you like you like something practical that you can take away and then use, you know, next week type thing.
Yeah, I do. I do like a takeaway. That's not to say someone like maybe Wayne Hemingway will talk maybe sort of bigger picture about design and stuff. But I think what's really interesting there, and what I think Collie has achieved in sort of getting him along, is we need to sort of embrace people from other industries and hear about how they've done things and the problems they have and relate them back to our own, because it can get kind of very insular, and you know, we can obsess about certain things that really, when you sort of look outside, there's far more interesting learning that we can get from other industries as well. So yeah, I think bringing someone like Wayne in, like I know him, Mr. Hemingway in to talk about his experience with Red or Dead and certainly some of his architecture stuff and well, this kind of thing will be really fascinating to see. So yeah, I'm looking forward to him.
Yeah, I think the most interesting things come when you look at, you know, what we do in the context of someone else's business, you know, in the context of someone else's world. It's, I find that sometimes we can get a bit too wrapped up in ourselves and, you know, the minutiae of what we do, and we don't necessarily spend enough time, you know, applying what we do to other people's stuff.
I think that's true.
So it's nice to hear from somebody in a different world, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And off to see Rob Mills, our friend Rob, speak at Second Wednesday, I believe it's called.
Yes, yeah.
So he'll be talking about Designing the Invisible, his book, and kind of nice sort of dovetail into sort of all the design talk the following day. But it's the last one. It's the last New Adventures. I think officially the last New Adventures.
It's a shame, or do you think it's good policy to be like, okay, I'm on a high, I'm going to stop now?
Well, it's the classic of anything, really. Do you quit while you're ahead, or do you just think you've got one more event in you? You know, I've spoken to Simon, and he's doing it for all the right reasons. Wants to go out with a bang, and I think he's, you know, he puts his heart and soul. Him and Greg, they both put their heart and soul into it, and so it is very much. I mean, I know it takes up a lot of their time, and organising events isn't that stress free. So I think the trilogy, as he's calling it, is come to an end, but I have a feeling that it will come back in some form or another in the future. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, but
perhaps under, you know, the banner of what he's doing with Fictive Kin.
Yeah, I think that's principally taking up a lot of his time, and so you know, sort of taking out 2 or 3 months to organise events, kind of not on the cards. But sure. We'll see. And definitely want to check out the newspaper. I hear there's some very good stuff in there this year.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. Definitely want to check that out. But so are you going to be riding there on your fixed gear bike, or are you going to be driving?
Your obsession with fixies.
No,
I prefer brakes and, you know, the safety of being able to stop.
I do confess, and I know this is a bit of a kind of oddball thing to end the show on, but I do have a mild fascination with fixed gear biking ever since watching... how do you say it? It's a very Bristolian way of saying it. So
Bike's Mind.
Say?
Bike's Mind.
Bike's Mind.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, yeah. It's, which is Gav Strange's film.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a really good film. It's about half an hour long, and it's around,
lovely film, yeah.
Fixed gear biking in Bristol, which is just down the road from both of us. But yeah, I keep digging out sites that allow me to customize my own fixed gear bike, and the latest one is Mango Bikes. But we were both playing around with it yesterday, and I think you went for the all black fixed gear with was it Bullrise bike? No, handles.
Yes, wasn't it? I went for the red rim.
The red rim, just on the front. Yeah, I would pay money to see you on that bike, actually.
Well, you know, I've not been on a bike in many years.
I mean, if I buy you that Mango fixed gear bike, would you ride it or no?
Yes.
Okay. I will be getting the PayPal out in a few moments and ordering. But it's not quite as good as the Zombie Stomper, though.
No, the Zombie Stomper, which was, what was that, green with pink handlebars, was very special.
But it's one of those things. So you're browsing around the web, and you'll be reading a site, say, I don't know, TechCrunch, and the Zombie Stomper advert will appear sort of just to the right of your eye line.
Do you think this might be because you've been browsing fixed gear bikes obsessively for about a year?
But it's kind of like Google doing its thing. It's suddenly, oh, there's a Zombie Stomper again. And coupled with that bag that I was looking at, you know, far too hipster. But no, we'll be...
Two.
Pardon me? Oh.
Hello?
Ugh, the Skype.
Ah, lovely.
Ah, well, but yeah. So we'll be hitting up new adventures, and yes, hopefully recording episode 2 of the Back to Front show live from the Premier Inn. You never know. Yeah. Come and say hello, and tell us why you like flat file sites. But yeah, so we've reached 41 minutes, believe it or not.
Which wow,
it's pretty short for us. We could have, of course, just record our phone conversations, but you know, we'd probably have too much material then.
Yeah, far too much material.
And we haven't even talked coffee or cocktails. Leave that for episode 2.
No. Yes, that can excellent. Be that can be our specialist subject.
But great. Okay, so this All Being Well will be out on Saturday. So if you're listening to this, we've done our job well. Hopefully not too many pops and you knows. We'll have to do a you know count. How many do you reckon?
It'll be enormous from me.
Do you reckon? Over 100?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, easily.
If anyone cares to count, do let us know. But we'll be back in 7 days, and thanks for listening.